bored and jaded dukes, but not for me. Oh, how proud, Aglaval smiled. How haughty. You reject offers in a way some kings wouldn't be ashamed of. You give up decent money with the air of a wealthy man after a lavish dinner. Geralt, did you have lunch today? No. And tomorrow, and the day after? I see little chance, Witcher, very little. It's difficult for you to find work normally, and now, with your arm in a sling. How dare you? Little Ike cried shrilly. How dare you speak like that to him, Aglaval? The arm he now carries in a sling was cut, carrying out your mission. How can you be so base?
Stop it, Geralt said. Stop, Essie. There's no point.
Not true, she said angrily. There is a point. Someone has to tell it straight to this self-appointed duke who took advantage of the fact that no one was challenging him for the title deed to rule this scrap of rocky coastline, and who now thinks he has the right to insult other people. Aglaval flushed and tightened his lips, but said nothing, and did not move. Yes, Aglaval, Essie continued, clenching her shaking hands into fists. The opportunity to insult other people amuses and pleases you. You delight in the contempt you can show the Witcher, who is prepared to risk his neck for your money. You should know, the Witcher mocks your contempt and slights. They do not make the faintest impression on him. He doesn't even notice them. No, the Witcher does not even feel what your servants and subjects Zelest and Drowhard feel, and they feel shame, deep, burning shame. The Witcher doesn't feel what Dandelion and I feel, and we feel revulsion. Do you know why that is, Aglaval? I'll tell you. The Witcher knows he is superior. He is worthier than you, and that gives him his strength. Essie fell silent and lowered her head, but not quickly enough for Geralt not to see the tear which sparkled in the corner of her gorgeous eye. The girl touched the little flower with silver petals hanging around her neck, the flower in the centre of which nestled a large sky-blue pearl. The little flower had intricate plaited petals, executed in masterly fashion. Drowhard, the Witcher thought, had come up trumps. The craftsman he had recommended did a good job and had not taken a penny from them. Drowhard had paid for everything. So, Your Grace, Little Eye continued, raising her head, don't make a fool of yourself by offering the Witcher the role of a mercenary in an army you plan to field against the ocean. Don't expose yourself to ridicule, for your suggestion could only prompt mirth. Don't you understand yet? You can pay the Witcher for carrying out a task. You can hire him to protect people from evil, to remove the danger that threatens them. But you cannot buy the Witcher. You cannot use him to your own ends, because the Witcher, even wounded and hungry, is better than you, has more worth. That is why he scorns your meagre offer. Do you understand?
No, Miss Darwin, Aglaval said coldly. I do not understand. On the contrary, I understand less and less. And the fundamental thing I indeed do not understand is why I have not yet ordered your entire trio hanged, after having you thrashed with a scourge and scorched with red-hot irons. You, Miss Darwin, are endeavouring to give the impression of somebody who knows everything. Tell me, then, why I do not do that.
As you please, the poet shot back at once. You do not do that, Aglaval, because somewhere, deep inside, glimmers in you a little spark of decency, a scrap of honour, not yet stifled by the vainglory of a nouveau riche and petty trader. Inside, Aglaval, at the bottom of your heart, a heart which, after all, is capable of loving a mermaid.
Aglaval went as white as a sheet and gripped the armrests of his chair. Bravo, the Witcher thought. Bravo, Essie, wonderful. He was proud of her, but at the same time he felt sorrow. Tremendous sorrow. Go away, Aglaval said softly. Go away, wherever you wish. Leave me in peace.
Farewell, Duke, Essie said. And on parting, accept some good advice. Advice which the Witcher ought to be giving you, but I don't want him to stoop to giving you advice, so I'll do it for him.
Very well.
The ocean is immense, Aglaval. No one has explored what lies beyond the horizon, if anything is there at all. The ocean is bigger than any wilderness, deep into which you have driven the elves. It is less accessible than any mountains or ravines where you have massacred werelynxes. And on the floor of the ocean dwells a race which uses weapons and knows the arcana of metalworking. Beware, Aglaval. If archers begin to sail with the pearl divers, you will begin a war with something you don't understand. What you mean to disturb may turn out to be a hornet's nest. I advise you, leave them the sea, for the sea is not for you. You don't know, and will never know, whither lead those steps which go down to the bottom of the dragon's fangs.
You are mistaken, Miss Darwin, Aglaval said calmly. We shall learn whither lead those steps. Further, we shall descend those steps. We shall find out what is on that side of the ocean, if there is anything there at all. And we shall draw from the ocean everything we can. And if not we, then our grandsons will do it, or our grandsons' grandsons. It is just a matter of time. Yes, we shall do it, though the ocean will run red with blood. And you know it, Essie, oh, wise Essie, who writes the chronicles of humanity in your ballads. Life is not a ballad, oh, poor little gorgeous-eyed poet, lost among her fine words. Life is a battle, and we were taught that struggle by these witches, whose worth is greater than ours. It was they who showed us the way, who paved the way for us. They strewed the path with the corpses of those who stood in the way of humans and defended that world from us. We, Essie, are only continuing that battle. It is we, not your ballads, who create the chronicles of humanity. And we no longer need witches, and now nothing will stop us. Nothing. Essie blanched, blew her lock away and tossed her head.
Nothing, Aglaval?
Nothing, Essie. The poet smiled. A sudden noise, shouts and stamping, came from the anterooms. Pages and guards rushed into the chamber. They knelt or bowed by the doors in two rows. Sheenats stood in the doorway. Her willow-green hair was elaborately coiffured, pinned up with a marvellous circlet encrusted with coral and pearls. She was in a gown the colour of seawater, with frills as white as foam. The gown had a plunging neckline, so that the mermaid's charms, though partly concealed and decorated with a necklace of nephrite and lapis lazuli, still earned the highest admiration.
Sheenats, Aglaval groaned, dropping to his knees. My Sheenats.
The mermaid slowly came closer, and her gait was soft and graceful, as fluid as an approaching wave. She stopped in front of the Duke, flashed her delicate white little teeth in a smile, then quickly gathered her gown in her small hands and lifted it quite high, high enough for everyone to be able to judge the quality of the marine sorceress, the Sea Witch. Geralt swallowed. There was no doubt the Sea Witch knew what shapely legs were and how to make them.
Ha! Dandelion cried. My ballad! It is just like in my ballad. She has gained legs for him, but has lost her voice. I have lost nothing, Sheenat said, melodiously in the purest common speech. For the moment, I am as good as new after the operation.
You speak our tongue?
What, mayn't I? How are you, White Hair? Oh, and your beloved one, Essie Darwin, if I recall, is here. Do you know her better, or still barely?
Sheenats, Aglaval groaned heartrendingly, moving towards her on his knees.
My love, my beloved, my only, and so, at last, Sheenats.
With a graceful movement, the mermaid proffered her hand to be kissed.
Indeed, because I love you too, you loon. And what kind of love would it be if the one who loves were not capable of a little sacrifice?
Chapter 9. They left Bremervoorde early on a cool morning, among fog which dulled the intensity of the red sun rolling out from below the horizon. They rode as a threesome, as they had agreed. They did not talk about it. They were making no plans. They simply wanted to be together for some time. They left the rocky headland, bade farewell to the precipitous jagged cliffs above the beaches, the fantastic limestone formations carved out by the sea and gales. But as they rode into the green flower-strewn valley of Dol Adelate, they still had the scent of the sea in their nostrils, and in their ears the roar of breakers and the piercing, urgent cries of seagulls. Dandelion talked ceaselessly, hopping from one subject to another and virtually not finishing any. He talked about the land of Barsa, where a stupid custom required girls to guard their chastity until marriage, about the iron birds of the island of Innisporoit, about living water and dead water, about the taste and curious properties of the sapphire wine called Sill, and about the royal quadruplets of Ebbing, dreadful, exasperating brats called Putzi, Gritzi, Mitzi, and Juan Pablo Vasemila. He talked about new trends in poetry promoted by his rivals, which were, in Dandelion's opinion, phantoms simulating the movements of the living. Geralt remained silent. Essie also said nothing, or replied in monosyllables. The Witcher felt her gaze on him. He avoided her eyes. They crossed the River Adelate on the ferry, having to pull the ropes themselves, since the ferryman happened to be in a pathetic, drunken state of deathly white, rigid trembling, gazing into the abyss pallor, unable to let go of the pillar in his porch, which he was clinging to with both hands, and answering every question they asked him with a single word, which sounded like, "Vog!" The Witcher had taken a liking to the country on the far side of the Adelate. The riverside villages were mainly surrounded by palisades, which portended a certain likelihood of finding work. Little Eye walked over to him while they were watering the horses in the early afternoon, taking advantage of the fact that Dandelion had wandered off. The Witcher was not quick enough. She surprised him.
"Geralt," she said softly, I can't bear this. I don't have the strength."
He tried to avoid the necessity of looking her in the eye, but she would not let him. She stood in front of him, toying with a sky-blue pearl set in a small silver flower hanging around her neck. She stood like that, and he wished again that it was the fish-eyed creature with its sword hidden beneath the water in front of him.
"Geralt, we have to do something about this, don't we?"
She waited for his answer, for some words, for a little sacrifice. But the Witcher had nothing he could sacrifice, and he knew it. He did not want to lie, and he truly did not have it in him, because he could not find the courage to cause her pain. The situation was saved by the sudden appearance of Dandelion, dependable Dandelion. Dandelion with his dependable tact.
"Of course!"
he yelled, and heaved into the water the stick he had been using to part the rushes and the huge riverside nettles.
"And of course you have to do something about it! It's high time! I have no wish to watch what is going on between you any longer. What do you expect from him, Poppet? The impossible? And you, Geralt, what are you hoping for? That Little Eye will read your thoughts like the other one? And she will settle for that, and you will conveniently stay quiet, not having to explain, declare or deny anything, and not have to reveal yourself? How much time, how many facts do you both need to understand? And when you'll want to recall it in a few years in your memories? I mean, we have to part tomorrow, damn it! I've had enough, by the gods. I'm up to here with you, up to here. Very well, listen. I'm going to break myself off a hazel rod and go fishing, and you will have some time to yourselves. You'll be able to tell each other everything. Tell each other everything, try to understand each other. It is not as difficult as you think. And after that, by the gods, do it. Do it with him, Poppet. Do it with her, Geralt, and be good to her. And then you'll either bloody get over it or..."
Dandelion turned around rapidly and walked away, breaking reeds and cursing. He made a rod from a hazel branch and horsehair and fished until dusk fell. After he had walked off, Geralt and Essie stood for a long time, leaning against a misshapen willow tree bent over the water. They stood, holding hands. Then the Witcher spoke softly for a long time, and Little Eye's little eye was full of tears. And then, by the gods, they did it, she and he. And everything was all right. Chapter 10. The next day, they organized something of a ceremonial supper. Essie and Geralt bought a dressed lamb in a village they passed through. While they were haggling, Dandelion surreptitiously stole some garlic, onions and carrots from the vegetable patch behind the cottage. As they were riding away, they also swiped a pot from the fence behind the smithy. The pot was a little leaky, but the Witcher soldered it using the Igni sign. The supper took place in a clearing deep in the forest. The fire crackled merrily and the pot bubbled. Geralt carefully stirred the stew with a star-shaped stirrer made from the top of a spruce tree stripped of bark. Dandelion peeled the onions and carrots. Little Eye, who had no idea about cooking, made the time more pleasant by playing the lute and singing racy couplets. It was a ceremonial supper, for they were going to part in the morning. In the morning, each of them was going to go their own way, in search of something they already had. But they did not know they had it. They could not even imagine it. They could not imagine where the roads they were meant to set off on the next morning would lead, each of them travelling separately. After they had eaten and drunk the beer Drowhard had given them, they gossiped and laughed, and Dandelion and Essie held a singing contest. Geralt lay on a makeshift bed of spruce branches with his hands under his head and thought he had never heard such beautiful voices or such beautiful ballads. He thought about Yennefer. He thought about Essie, too. He had a presentiment that, at the end, Little Eye and Dandelion sang the celebrated duet of Cynthia and Vertvern, a wonderful song of love, beginning with the words, "Many tears have I shed." It seemed to Geralt that even the trees bent down to listen to the two of them. Then Little Eye, smelling of verbena, lay down beside him, squeezed in under his arm, wiggled her head onto his chest, sighed maybe once or twice, and fell peacefully asleep. The Witcher fell asleep much, much later. Dandelion, staring into the dying embers, sat much longer alone, quietly strumming his lute. It began with a few bars, from which an elegant, soothing melody emerged. The lyric suited the melody and came into being simultaneously with it, the words blending into the music, becoming set in it like insects in translucent golden lumps of amber. The ballad told of a certain witcher and a certain poet, about how the witcher and the poet met on the seashore among the crying of seagulls, and how they fell in love at first sight. About how beautiful and powerful was their love, about how nothing, not even death, was able to destroy that love and part them. Dandelion knew that few would believe the story told by the ballad, but he was not concerned. He knew ballads were not written to be believed, but to move their audience. Several years later, Dandelion could have changed the contents of the ballad and written about what had really occurred. He did not, for the true story would not have moved anyone. Who would have wanted to hear that the Witcher and Little Eye parted and never ever saw each other again? About how, 4 years later, Little Eye died of the smallpox during an epidemic raging in Vitsima. About how he, Dandelion, had carried her out in his arms between corpses being cremated on funeral pyres, and had buried her far from the city in the forest, alone and peaceful, and, as she had asked, buried two things with her, her lute and her sky-blue pearl. The pearl from which she was never parted. No. Dandelion stuck with his first version, and he never sang it. Never. To no one. Right before the dawn, while it was still dark, a hungry, vicious werewolf crept up to their camp, but saw that it was Dandelion, so he listened for a moment, and then went on his way. The Sword of Destiny. Chapter 1. He found the first body around noon. The sight of victims of violent death seldom shocked the Witcher. Much more often, he looked at corpses with total indifference. This time, he was not indifferent. The boy was around 15. He was lying on his back, legs sprawled, his face frozen in a grimace of terror. In spite of that, Geralt knew the boy had died at once, had not suffered, and probably had not even known he was dying. The arrow had struck him in the eye and was driven deep into the skull through the occipital bone. The arrow was fletched with striped pheasant flight feathers dyed yellow. The shaft stuck up above the tufts of grass. Geralt looked around and quickly and easily found what he was hunting for. A second, identical arrow, lodged in the trunk of a pine tree, around 6 paces behind the corpse. He knew what had happened. The boy had not understood the warning, and hearing the whistle and thud of the arrow, had panicked and begun to run the wrong way, towards the one who had ordered him to stop and withdraw at once. The hissing, venomous feathered whistle and the short thud of the arrowhead cutting into the wood. "Not a step further, man," said that whistle and that thud. "Be gone, man. Get out of Broquelon at once. You have captured the whole world, man. You are everywhere. Everywhere you introduce what you call modernity, the era of change, what you call progress. But we want neither you nor your progress here. We do not desire the changes you bring. We do not desire anything you bring." A whistle and a thud. "Get out of Broquelon." "Get out of Broquelon," thought Geralt. "Man. No matter that you are 15 and struggling through the forest, insane with fear, unable to find your way home. No matter that you are 70 and have to gather brushwood, because otherwise they will drive you from the cottage for being useless. They will stop giving you food. No matter that you are 6 and were lured by a carpet of little blue flowers in a sunny clearing. Get out of Broquelon." A whistle and a thud. Long ago, thought Geralt, before they shot to kill, they gave 2 warnings, even 3. Long ago, he thought, continuing on his way. Long ago. Well, that's progress. The forest did not seem to deserve the dreadful notoriety it enjoyed. It was terribly wild and arduous to march through, but it was the commonplace arduousness of a dense forest, where every gap, every patch of sunlight filtered by the boughs and leafy branches of huge trees was immediately exploited by dozens of young birches, alders and hornbeams, by brambles, junipers and ferns, the tangle of shoots covering the crumbly mire of rotten wood, dry branches and decayed trunks of the oldest trees, the ones that had lost the fight, the ones that had lived out their lifespan. The thicket, however, did not generate the ominous, weighty silence which would have suited the place more. No, Broquelon was alive. Insects buzzed, lizards rustled the grass underfoot. Iridescent beetles scuttled, thousands of spiders tugged webs, glistening with drops of water. Woodpeckers thumped tree trunks with sharp series of raps, and jays screeched. Broquelon was alive. But the Witcher did not let himself be deceived. He knew where he was. He remembered the boy with the arrow in his eye. He had occasionally seen white bones with red ants crawling over them among the moss and pine needles. He walked on, cautiously but swiftly. The trail was fresh. He hoped to reach and send back the men walking in front of him. He deluded himself that it was not too late. But it was. He would not have noticed the next corpse had it not been for the sunlight reflecting on the blade of the short sword it was gripping. It was a grown man. His simple clothing, coloured a practical dun, indicated his lowly status. His garments, not counting the bloodstains surrounding the 2 feathers sticking into his chest, were clean and new. So he could not have been a common servant. Geralt looked around and saw a 3rd body, dressed in a leather jacket and short green cape. The ground around the dead man's legs was churned up. The moss and pine needles were furrowed right down to the sand. There was no doubt this man had taken a long time to die. He heard a groan. He quickly parted the juniper bushes and saw the deep tree throw they were concealing. A powerfully built man, with black curly hair and beard contrasting with the dreadful, downright deathly pallor of his face, was lying in the hollow on the exposed roots of the pine. His pale, deerskin caftan was red with blood. The Witcher jumped into the hollow. The wounded man opened his eyes.
"Geralt," he groaned. "Oh, ye gods, I must be dreaming."
"Frexenet," the Witcher asked in astonishment. "You here?"
"Yes, me. Oh."
"Don't move," Geralt said, kneeling beside him. "Where were you hit? I can't see the arrow."
"It passed right through. I broke off the arrowhead and pulled it out. Listen, Geralt."
"Be quiet, Frexenet, or you'll choke on your blood. You have a punctured lung. A pox on it. I have to get you out of here. What the bloody hell were you doing in Broquelon? It's Dryad territory. They're sanctuary. No one gets out of here alive. I can't believe you didn't know that.
Later."
Frexenet groaned and spat blood.
tell you later. Now get me out. Box on it. Have a care. Oh!
I can't do it, Geralt said, straightening up and looking around. You're too heavy.
Leave me, the wounded man grunted. Leave me. Too bad. But save her. Oh, by the gods, save her.
Who?
The princess. Oh. Find her, Geralt.
Lie still, damn it. I'll knock something up and haul you out. Frexinet coughed hard and spat again. A viscous, stretching thread of blood hung from his chin. The Witcher cursed, vaulted out of the hollow and looked around. He needed two young saplings. He moved quickly towards the edge of the clearing where he had seen a clump of alders. A whistle and thud. Geralt froze to the spot. The arrow, buried in a tree trunk at head height, had hawk feather fletchings. He looked at the angle of the ashen shaft and knew where it had been shot from. About 4 dozen paces away, there was another hollow, a fallen tree, and a tangle of roots sticking up in the air, still tightly gripping a huge lump of sandy earth. There was a dark mass of blackthorn there, amid the lighter stripes of birches. He could not see anyone. He knew he would not. He raised both hands very slowly.
Cheidmel, Varanaithni, Mitha, Duen Canel. I see a Gwynblaith.
This time, he heard the soft twang of the bowstring and saw the arrow, for it had been shot for him to see, powerfully. He watched it soar upwards, saw it reach its apex, and then fall in a curve. He did not move. The arrow plunged into the moss almost vertically, 2 paces from him. Almost immediately, a second lodged next to the first at exactly the same angle. He was afraid he might not see the next one.
Meathaithne, he called again. Is there Gwynblaith?
Gladder fort.
A voice like a breath of wind. A voice, not an arrow. He was alive. He slowly unfastened his belt buckle, drew his sword well away from himself and threw it down. A second dryad emerged noiselessly from behind a fir trunk wrapped around with juniper bushes, no more than 10 paces from him. Although she was small and very slim, the trunk seemed thinner. He had no idea how he had not seen her as he approached. Perhaps her outfit had disguised her, a patchwork which accentuated her shapely form, sewn weirdly from scraps of fabric in numerous shades of green and brown, strewn with leaves and pieces of bark. Her hair, tied with a black scarf around her forehead, was olive green, and her face was crisscrossed with stripes painted using walnut shell dye. Naturally, her bowstring was taut, and she was aiming an arrow at him.
Aithne, he began.
Dyasep!
He obediently fell silent, standing motionless, holding his arms away from his trunk. The dryad did not lower her bow.
Dunka, she cried. Brian, Kimvort!
The one who had shot the arrows earlier darted out from the blackthorn and slipped over the upturned trunk, nimbly clearing the depression. Although there was a pile of dry branches in it, Geralt did not hear even one snap beneath her feet. He heard a faint murmur close behind, something like the rustling of leaves in the wind. He knew there was a third. It was that one, dashing out from behind him, who picked up his sword. Her hair was the colour of honey and was tied up with a band of bulrush fibres. A quiver full of arrows swung on her back. The furthest one approached the tree throw swiftly. Her outfit was identical to that of her companions. She wore a garland woven from clover and heather on her dull, brick-red hair. She was holding a bow, not bent, but with an arrow knocked.
Den besser in meath ab eithnechlef?
She asked, coming over. Her voice was extremely melodious, and her eyes, huge and black.
Es Gwynblaith?
Aye, Isia, he began,
but the words in the Brokilon dialect, which sounded like singing in the dryad's mouth, stuck in his throat and made his lips itchy.
Do none of you know the common speech? I don't speak you.
Anvail, Vortlicha,
she cut him off.
I am Gwynblaith, White Wolf. Lady Aithne knows me. I am travelling to her as an envoy. I have been in Brokilon before, in Duin Canell.
Gwynblaith?
The redhead narrowed her eyes.
Vatrien.
Yes, he confirmed. The Witcher.
The olive-haired one snorted angrily, but lowered her bow. The red-haired one looked at him with eyes wide open, but her face, smeared with green stripes, was quite motionless, expressionless, like that of a statue. The immobility meant her face could not be categorized as pretty or ugly. Instead of such classification, a thought came to him about indifference and heartlessness, not to say cruelty. Geralt reproached himself for that judgment, catching himself mistakenly humanizing the dryad. He ought to have known, after all, that she was older than the other two. In spite of appearances, she was much, much older than them. They stood in indecisive silence. Geralt heard Flexinet moaning, groaning and coughing. The red-haired one must also have heard, but her face did not even twitch. The Witcher rested his hands on his hips.
"There's a wounded man over there in the tree hole," he said calmly. "He will die if he doesn't receive aid."
"Pay us up!"
the olive-haired one snapped, bending her bow and aiming the arrowhead straight at his face.
"Will you let him die like a dog?" he said, not raising his voice. "Will you leave him to drown slowly in his own blood? In that case, better to put him out of his misery."
"Be silent,"
the dryad barked, switching to the common speech. But she lowered her bow and released the tension on the bowstring. She looked at the other questioningly. The red-haired one nodded, indicating the tree hollow. The olive-haired one ran over quickly and silently.
"I want to see Lady Eithne," Geralt repeated. "I'm on a diplomatic mission."
"She..."
the red-haired one pointed to the honey-haired one.
"We'll lead you to Duinkanel. Go."
"Frex. And the wounded man?"
The dryad looked at him squinting. She was still fiddling with the knocked arrow.
"Do not worry," she said. "Go. She will lead you there."
"But they have thought..."
She cut him off, her lips tightening. He shrugged and turned towards the one with the hair the colour of honey. She seemed the youngest of the three, but he might have been mistaken. He noticed she had blue eyes.
"Then let us go."
"Yes,"
the honey-coloured haired one said softly. After a short moment of hesitation, she handed him his sword.
"Let us go."
"What is your name?" he asked.
"Be silent."
She moved very swiftly through the dense forest, not looking back. Geralt had to exert himself to keep up with her. He knew the dryad was doing it deliberately, knew that she wanted the man following her to get stuck, groaning in the undergrowth, or to fall to the ground exhausted, incapable of going on. She did not know, of course, that she was dealing with a witcher, not a man. She was too young to know what a witcher was. The young woman, Geralt now knew she was not a pure-blood dryad, suddenly stopped and turned around. He saw her chest heaving powerfully beneath her short, dappled jacket, saw that she was having difficulty stopping herself from breathing through her mouth.
"Shall we slow down?" he suggested with a smile.
"Yeah."
She looked at him with hostility.
"Ain, is I a she?"
"No, I'm not an elf. What is your name?"
"Brian,"
she answered, marching on, but now at a slower pace, not trying to outdistance him. They walked alongside each other, close. He smelled the scent of her sweat, the ordinary sweat of a young woman. The sweat of dryads carried the scent of delicate willow leaves crushed in the hands.
"And what were you called before?"
She glanced at him and suddenly grimaced. He thought she would become annoyed or order him to be silent. She did not.
"I don't remember,"
she said reluctantly. He did not think it was true. She did not look older than 16, and she could not have been in Brokilon for more than 6 or 7 years. Had she come earlier, as a very young child, or simply a baby, he would not now be able to see the human in her. Blue eyes and naturally fair hair did occur among dryads. Dryad children, conceived in ritual mating with elves or humans, inherited organic traits exclusively from their mothers and were always girls. Extremely infrequently, as a rule, in a subsequent generation, a child would nonetheless occasionally be born with the eyes or hair of its anonymous male progenitor. But Geralt was certain that Brienne did not have a single drop of dryad blood. And anyway, it was not especially important. Blood or not, she was now a dryad.
"And what?"
She looked askance at him.
"Do they call you?"
"Gwyn Blythe."
She nodded.
"Then we shall go. Gwyn Blythe."
They walked more slowly than before, but still briskly. Brienne, of course, knew Broquelon. Had he been alone, Geralt would have been unable to maintain the pace or the right direction. Brienne stole through the barricade of dense forest, using winding, concealed paths, clearing gorges, running nimbly across fallen trees as though they were bridges, confidently splashing through glistening stretches of swamp, green from duckweed, which the Witcher would not have dared to tread on. He would have lost hours, if not days, skirting around. Brienne's presence did not only protect him from the savagery of the forest. There were places where the dryad slowed down, walking extremely cautiously, feeling the path with her foot and holding him by the hand. He knew the reason. Broquelon's traps were legendary. People talked about pits full of sharpened stakes, about booby-trapped bows, about falling trees, about the terrible urchin, a spiked ball on a rope, which falling suddenly swept the path clear. There were also places where Brienne would stop and whistle melodiously, and answering whistles would come from the undergrowth. There were other places where she would stop with her hand on the arrows in her quiver, signalling for him to be silent and wait, tense, until whatever was rustling in the thicket moved away. In spite of their fast pace, they had to stop for the night. Brienne chose an excellent spot, a hill onto which thermal updrafts carried gusts of warm air. They slept on dried bracken, very close to one another, in dryad custom. In the middle of the night, Brienne hugged him close, and nothing more. He hugged her back, and nothing more. She was a dryad. The point was to keep warm. They set off again at daybreak, while it was still almost dark. Chapter 2 They passed through a belt of sparsely forested hills, creeping cautiously across small valleys full of mist, moving through broad, grassy glades and across clearings of wind-felled trees. Brienne stopped once again and looked around. She had apparently lost her way, but Geralt knew that was impossible. Taking advantage of a break in the march, however, he sat down on a fallen tree. And then he heard a scream. Shrill, high-pitched, desperate. Brienne knelt down in a flash, at once drawing two arrows from her quiver. She seized one in her teeth and knocked the other, bent her bow, taking aim blindly through the bushes towards the sound of the voice. "Don't shoot!" he cried. He leapt over the tree trunk and forced his way through the brush. A small creature in a short grey jacket was standing in a small clearing at the foot of a rocky cliff, with its back pressed against the trunk of a withered hornbeam. Something was moving slowly about 5 paces in front of it, parting the grass. That thing was about 12 feet long and was dark brown. At first, Geralt thought it was a snake, but then he noticed the wriggling yellow hooked limbs and flat segments of the long thorax and realized it was not a snake. It was something much more sinister. The creature hugging the tree cried out shrilly. The immense myriapod raised above the grass long, twitching feelers with which it sensed odours and warmth. "Don't move!" the Witcher yelled, and stamped to attract the scolopendromorph's attention. But the myriapod did not react, for its feelers had already caught the scent of the nearer victim. The monster wriggled its limbs, coiled itself up like an S, and moved forward. Its bright yellow limbs rippled through grass evenly, like the oars of a galley.
"Higgian!"
Brienne yelled. Geralt hurtled into the clearing in 2 bounds, jerking his sword from its scabbard on his back as he ran, and in full flight struck the petrified creature beneath the tree with his hip, shoving it aside into some brambles. The scolopendromorph rustled the grass, wriggled its legs and attacked, raising its anterior segments, its venom-dripping pincers chattering. Geralt danced, leapt over the flat body, and slashed it with his sword from a half-turn, aiming at a vulnerable spot between the armoured plates on its body. The monster was too swift, however, and the sword struck the chitinous shell without cutting through it. The thick carpet of moss absorbed the blow. Geralt dodged, but not deftly enough. The scolopendromorph wound the posterior part of its body around his legs with enormous strength. The Witcher fell, rolled over, and tried to pull himself free. In vain. The myriapod flexed and turned around to reach him with its pincers, and at the same time fiercely dug its claws into the tree and wrapped itself around it. Right then, an arrow hissed above Geralt's head, penetrating the armour with a crack, pinning the creature to the trunk. The scolopendromorph writhed, broke the arrow and freed itself, but was struck at once by 2 more. The Witcher kicked the thrashing abdomen off and rolled away to the side. Brienne, kneeling, was shooting at an astonishing rate, sending arrow after arrow into the scolopendromorph. The myriapod was breaking the shafts to free itself, but each successive arrow would pin it to the trunk again. The creature snapped its flat, shiny, dark red maw and clanged its pincers by the places which had been pierced by the arrows, instinctively trying to reach the enemy which was wounding it. Geralt leapt at it from the side, took a big swing, and hacked with his sword, ending the fight with one blow. The tree acted like an executioner's block. Brienne approached slowly, an arrow knocked, kicked the body writhing in the grass, its limbs thrashing around, and spat on it.
"Thanks," the Witcher said, crushing the beast's severed head with blows of his heel.
"Eh?
You saved my life."
The Dryad looked at him. There was neither understanding nor emotion in her expression.
"Kikirn," she said, nudging the writhing body with a boot. "It broke my arrows."
"You saved my life, and that little Dryad's," Geralt repeated. "Where the bloody hell is she?"
Brienne deftly brushed aside the bramble thicket and plunged an arm among the thorny shoots.
"As I thought," she said, pulling the little creature in the grey jacket from the thicket. "See for yourself, Gwynblythe."
It was not a Dryad. Neither was it an elf, sylph, puck, or halfling. It was a quite ordinary little human girl. In the centre of Broquelon, it was the most extraordinary place to come across an ordinary human little girl. She had fair, mousy hair and huge, glaringly green eyes. She could not have been more than 10 years old.
"Who are you?" he asked. "How did you get here?"
She did not reply.
"Where have I seen her before?" he wondered. "I've seen her before somewhere. Either her or someone very similar to her." "Don't be afraid," he said hesitantly.
"I'm not afraid,"
she mumbled indistinctly. She clearly had a cold.
"Let us get out of here," Brienne suddenly said, looking all around. "Where there is one Ygerne, you can usually expect another, and I have few arrows now."
The girl looked at her, opened her mouth, and wiped it with the back of her hand, smearing dust over her face.
"Who the hell are you?" Geralt asked again, leaning forward. "What are you doing in this forest? How did you get here?"
The girl lowered her head and sniffed loudly.
"Cat got your tongue?" "Who are you?" I said. "What's your name?"
"Ciri,"
she said, sniffing. Geralt turned around. Brienne, examining her bow, glanced at him.
"Listen, Brienne."
"What?"
"Is it possible? Is it possible she has escaped from Duin Canell?"
"Eh?"
"Don't play dumb," he said, annoyed. "I know your ducked little girls. And you. What? Did you fall from the sky into Broquelon? I'm asking if it's possible."
"No."
The Dryad cut him off.
"I have never seen her before."
Geralt looked at the little girl. Her ashen grey hair was dishevelled, full of pine needles and small leaves, but smelled of cleanliness, not smoke, nor the cowshed, nor tallow. Her hands, although incredibly dirty, were small and delicate, without scars or calluses. The boy's clothes, the jacket with the red hood she had on, did not indicate anything, but her high boots were made of soft, expensive calfskin. No, she was certainly not a village child.
Frexinet, the Witcher suddenly thought. This was the one that Frexinet was looking for. He'd followed her into Broquelon.
"Where are you from? I'm asking you, you scamp."
"How dare you talk to me like that?"
The little girl lifted her head haughtily and stamped her foot. The soft moss completely spoiled the effect.
"Ha," the Witcher said and smiled. "A princess indeed. At least in speech, for your appearance is wretched. You're from Verden, aren't you? Do you know you're being looked for? Don't worry, I'll deliver you home. Listen, Brienne."
The moment he looked away, the girl turned very quickly on her heel and ran off through the forest across the gentle hillside.
"Bloody dung!"
the Dryad yelled, reaching for her quiver.
"Come here!"
The little girl, stumbling, rushed blindly through the forest, crunching over dry branches.
"Stop!" shouted Geralt. "Where are you bloody going?"
Brienne bent her bow in a flash. The arrow hissed venomously, describing a flat parabola, and the arrowhead thudded into the tree trunk, almost brushing the little girl's hair. The girl cringed and flattened herself to the ground.
"You bloody fool!"
the Witcher hissed, hurrying over to the Dryad. Brienne deftly drew another arrow from her quiver.
You might have killed her.
This is Broccolon, she said proudly.
But she's only a child.
What of it?
He looked at the arrow's shaft. It had striped fletchings made from a pheasant's flight feathers dyed yellow in a decoction of tree bark. He did not say a word. He turned around and went quickly into the forest. The little girl was lying beneath the tree, cowering, cautiously raising her head and looking at the arrow stuck into the tree. She heard his steps and leapt to her feet, but he reached her with a single bound and seized her by the red hood of her jacket. She turned her head and looked at him, then at his hand, holding her hood. He released her.
Why did you run away?
None of your business, she sniffed. Leave me alone, you
foolish brat, he hissed furiously. This is Broccolon. Wasn't the myriapod enough? You wouldn't last till morning in this forest. Haven't you got it yet?
Don't touch me, she yelled. You peasant. I'm a princess, so you better be careful.
You're a foolish imp.
I'm a princess.
Princesses don't roam through forests alone. Princesses have clean noses.
I'll have you beheaded, and her too.
The girl wiped her nose with her hand and glared at the approaching dryad. Brienne snorted with laughter.
All right, enough of this, the witcher cut her off. Why were you running away, your highness? And where to? What were you afraid of?
She said nothing and sniffed.
Very well, as you wish. He winked at the dryad. We're going. If you want to stay alone in the forest, that's your choice. But the next time a Yegern attacks you, don't yell. It doesn't befit a princess. A princess dies without even a squeal, having first wiped her snotty nose. Let's go, Brienne. Farewell, your highness.
Wait!
Aha!
I'm coming with you.
We are greatly honoured, aren't we, Brienne?
But you won't take me to Kistrin again, do you swear?
Who is... he began. Oh, damn it. Kistrin. Prince Kistrin, the son of King Ervil of Verden.
The little girl pouted her lips, sniffed and turned away.
Enough of these trifles, said Brienne grimly. Let us march on.
Hold on, hold on.
The witcher straightened up and looked down at the dryad.
Our plans are changing somewhat, my comely archer.
Eh?
Brienne said, raising her eyebrows.
Lady Eithne can wait. I have to take the little one home, to Verden.
The dryad squinted and reached for her quiver.
You're not going anywhere. Nor is she.
The witcher smiled hideously.
Be careful, Brienne, he said. I'm not that pup whose eye you speared with an arrow from the undergrowth. I can look after myself.
Bloody arse, she hissed, raising her bow. You're going to Duinkanell, and so is she, not to Verden. No, not to Verden,
the mousy-haired girl said, throwing herself at the dryad and pressing herself against her slim thigh.
I'm going with you. And he could go to Verden by himself, to silly old Kistrin, if he wants.
Brienne did not even look at her, did not take her eyes off Geralt, but she lowered her bow.
Yes, donc, she said, spitting at his feet. Very well, then go on your way. We'll see how you fare. You'll kiss an arrow before you leave Broccolon.
She's right, thought Geralt. I don't have a chance. Without her, I won't get out of Broccolon, nor reach Duinkanell. Too bad. We shall see. Perhaps I'll manage to persuade Eithne. Very well, Brienne, he said placatingly, and smiled. Don't be furious, fair one. Very well, have it your way. We shall all go to Duinkanell, to Lady Eithne.
The dryad muttered something under her breath and unknocked the arrow.
To the road, then, she said, straightening her hairband. We have tarried too long.
Oh!
The little girl yelped as she took a step.
What's the matter?
I've done something to my leg.
Wait, Brienne. Come here, scamp. I'll carry your pickaback.
She was warm and smelt like a wet sparrow.
What's your name, princess? I've forgotten.
Ciri.
And your estates? Where do they lie, if I may ask?
I won't tell, she grunted. I won't tell, and that's that.
I'll get by. Don't wriggle or sniff right by my ear. What were you doing in Broccolon? Did you get lost? Did you lose your way?
Not a chance. I'd never get lost.
Don't wriggle. Did you run away from Kistrin? From Nastrog Castle? Before or after the wedding?
How did you know?
She sniffed intent. I'm staggeringly intelligent. Why did you run away to Brokilon, of all places? Weren't there any safer directions?
I couldn't control my stupid horse.
You're lying, Princess. Looking at your size, the most you could ride is a cat, and a gentle one at that.
I was riding with Mark, Sir Voimir's esquire, but the horse fell in the forest and broke its leg, and we lost our way.
You said that never happens to you.
He got lost, not me. It was foggy, and we lost our way.
You got lost, thought Geralt. Sir Voimir's poor esquire, who had misfortune to happen upon Brienne and her companions. A young stripling who had probably never known a woman. Helped the green-eyed scamp escape because he'd heard a lot of knightly stories about virgins being forced to marry. He helped her escape to fall to a dryad's dyed arrow, one who probably hasn't known a man herself, but already knows how to kill. I asked you if you bolted from Nastrog Castle before or after the wedding.
I just scarped and it's none of your business, she grunted. Grandmama told me I had to go there and meet him, that Kistred, just meet him. But that father of his, that big-bellied king...
Urville.
Kept on... The wedding. But I don't want him, that Kistred. Grandmama said...
Is Prince Kistred so revolting?
I don't want him,
Ciri proudly declared, sniffing loudly.
He's fat, stupid, and his breath spells. Before I went there, they showed me a painting, but he wasn't fat in the painting. I don't want a husband like that. I don't want a husband at all.
Ciri, the witcher said hesitantly, Kistrin is still a child like you. In a few years he might turn into a handsome young man.
Then they could send me another painting in a few years, she snorted. And him, too, because he told me that I was much prettier in the painting they showed him, and he confessed that he loves Alvina, a lady-in-waiting, and he wants to be a knight. See? He doesn't want me and I don't want him. So what use is a wedding?
Ciri, the witcher muttered. He's a prince, and you're a princess. Princes and princesses marry like that. That's how it is. That's the custom.
You sound like all the rest. You think that just because I'm small, you can lie to me.
I'm not lying.
Yes, you are.
Geralt said nothing. Brienne, walking in front of them, turned around, probably surprised by the silence. She shrugged and set off.
Which way are we going? Ciri asked glumly. I want to know.
Geralt said nothing.
Answer when I ask a question,
she said menacingly, backing up the order with a loud sniff.
Do you know who's sitting on you?
He didn't react.
I'll bite you in the ear, she yelled.
The witcher had had enough. He pulled the girl off his back and put her on the ground. Now listen, you brat, he said harshly, struggling with his belt buckle. In a minute, I'll put you across my knee, pull down your breeches and tan your backside. No one will stop me doing it because this isn't the royal court and I'm not your flunky or servant. You'll soon regret you didn't stay in Nastrog. You'll soon see it's better being a princess than a snot-nosed kid who got lost in the forest. Because it's true, a princess is allowed to act obnoxiously and no one thrashes a princess's backside with a belt. At most, her husband, the prince, might with his own hand. Ciri cowered and sniffed a few times. Brienne watched dispassionately, leaning against a tree. Well? The witcher asked, wrapping his belt around his wrist. Are we going to behave with dignity and temperance? If not, we shall set about tanning Her Majesty's hide. Well? What's it to be? The little girl snivelled and sniffed, then eagerly nodded. Are you going to be good, princess?
Yes,
she mumbled.
Gloaming will soon fall, the dryad said. Let us make haste, Gwynblythe.
The forest thinned out. They walked through a sandy young forest, across moors and through fog-cloaked meadows with herds of red deer grazing. It was growing cooler.
Noble lord,
Ciri began after a long, long silence. My name is Geralt. What's the matter?
I'm awfully hungry.
We'll stop in a moment. It'll be dark soon.
I can't go on, she snivelled. I haven't eaten since.
Stop whining. He reached into a saddlebag and took out a piece of fatback, a small round of white cheese and two apples. Have that.
What's that yellow stuff?
Fatback.
I wouldn't eat that,
she grunted. That's fine, he said indistinctly, stuffing the fatback into his mouth. Eat the cheese and an apple. Just one.
Why only one?
Don't wriggle. Have both.
Geralt?
Hmm?
Thank you.
Don't mention it. Food'll do you good.
I didn't... Not for that. That too, but... You saved me from that centipede. Almost died of fright.
You almost died, he confirmed seriously. You almost died in an extremely painful and hideous way, he thought. But you ought to thank Brienne.
What is she?
A dryad.
An eerie wife?
Yes.
So she's... They kidnapped children. She's kidnapped us. Hey, but you aren't small. But why does she speak so strangely?
That's just her way. It's not important. What's important is how she shoots. Don't forget to thank her when we stop.
I won't forget,
she sniffed. Don't wriggle, future princess of Erden, ma'am.
I'm not going to be a princess,
she muttered. Very well, very well. You won't be a princess. You'll become a hamster and live in a burrow.
No, I won't. You don't know anything.
Don't squeak in my ear. And don't forget about the strap.
I'm not going to be a princess. I'm going to be...
Yes? What?
It's a secret.
Oh, yes. A secret. Splendid. He raised his head. What is it, Brienne?
The dryad had stopped. She shrugged and looked at the sky.
I cannot go on, she said softly. Neither can you, I warrant, with her on your back, Queen Blythe. We shall stop here. It will darken soon.
Chapter 3
Ciri.
Hmm?
The little girl sniffed and rustled the branches she was lying on.
Aren't you cold?
No, she sighed. It's warm today. Yesterday I froze offy. Oh my, how I did.
It is a marvel,
Brienne said, loosing the straps of her long, soft boots.
A tiny little moppet, but she has covered a long stride of forest, and she got past the lookouts, through the bog and the thicket. She is robust, healthy and stout. Truly, she would come in useful to us.
Geralt glanced quickly at the dryad, at her eyes shining in the semi-darkness. Brienne leaned back against a tree, removed her hairband, and let her hair down with a shake of her head.
She entered Broccolon, she muttered, forestalling his comment. She is ours, Gwyn Blythe. We are marching to Duin Canell.
Lady Aethne will decide, he responded tartly, but he knew Brienne was right.
Pity, he thought, looking at the little girl wriggling on the green bed. She's such a determined rascal. Where have I seen her before?
Oh, never mind. But it's a pity. The world is so big and so beautiful. And Broccolon will now be her world until the end of her days, and there may not be many. Perhaps only until the day she falls in the bracken amidst cries and the whistles of arrows, fighting in this senseless battle for the forest, on the side of those who will lose, who have to lose, sooner or later. Ciri?
Yes?
Where do your parents live?
I don't have any parents, she sniffed. They drowned at sea when I was tiny.
Yes, he thought. That explains a lot. A princess, the child of a deceased royal couple. Who knows if she isn't the third daughter following four sons, a title which in practice means less than that of chamberlain or equerry. A mousy-haired, green-eyed thing hanging around the court who ought to be shoved out as quickly as possible and married off as quickly as possible before she matures and becomes a young woman and brings the threat of scandal, misalliance or incest, which would not be difficult in a shared castle bedchamber. Her escape did not surprise the Witcher. He had frequently met princesses, and even queens, roaming around with troops of wandering players, happy to have escaped some decrepit king, still desirous of an heir. He had seen princes, preferring the uncertain fate of a soldier of fortune to marriage, to a lame or pockmarked princess chosen by their father, whose withered or doubtful virginity was to be the price of an alliance or dynastic coalition. He lay down beside the little girl and covered her with his jacket. Sleep, he said. Sleep, little orphan.
Orphan? she growled. I'm a princess, not an orphan. And I have a grandmama. And my grandmama is a queen, so you'd better be careful. When I tell her you wanted to give me the strap, my grandmama will order your head chopped off. You'll see.
Ghastly,
Ciri, have mercy.
Not a chance.
But you're a good little girl, and beheading hurts awfully. You won't say anything, will you?
I will.
Ciri.
I will.
Afraid, are you?